But actually, they know who Eric is, so I might as well introduce Eric while we're waiting for them to join in. So we're very pleased to have, thank you everybody for coming. We're very pleased to have Eric Carrion with us today, who's now a postdoc at the Rotman Institute for Philosophy at the University of Western Ontario. Eric got his PhD from the University of Chicago, and he was just telling me that he was co-supervised by David Malamut and by Howard Stein, but that Bob Garrosh also played an important role in that process. So not surprising that his topic is about classical mechanics and Lagrangian and Newtonian structures. Since then, he's had a number of postdocs, including this one, and a postdoc also at the Center for Philosophy of Science at the University of Pittsburgh. So welcome, Eric, and hopefully we will see Western. It's up to you. If you want to start now, or if you want to wait for 1 or 2 minutes to make sure everybody's on the same page.
How about if I give them 30 more seconds or so?
Okay.
And then we'll start.
Yeah.
That must have been a philosopher who said that.
Yes, that's what they call me here in
the room. Screw it, I'll start early. Okay, so the title of my talk is Classical Mechanics is Lagrangian. It is not Hamiltonian. Wait, where's this thing? Here it is. So the outline, I'm first going to very briefly sketch what I call a pre-theoretical characterization of what I mean by a classical system. It's I'm going to sketch a mathematical framework that's general enough to capture the idea of the very general idea of a classical system. And by classical, I mean not quantum and not relativistic, something roughly that's can be treated by Newton's second law. I will then show how by making one assumption that's based on empirical observation, I'll be able to characterize the family of possible interactions on the space of states of the classical system, and that will lead to a natural characterization of the geometrical structure of the family of possible evolutions. Which
we're here. All right, yay.
Can you hear us, Western?
Can you hear us, Wayne? Can you hear us? Hello? We need the sound. We got the vision.
Someone wave if you can hear us.
Wave if you can hear us.
All right,
okay, fine. Right, that will allow me to show that, in fact, the abstract space of states that I assumed at first in a natural way allows the construction of a configuration space naturally associated with it, and actually show that the space of states is naturally isomorphic to the tangent bundle over the configuration space. That will lead directly into the argument that, in fact, all the structure that I characterized in section 2 based on this one empirical assumption leads very naturally to the construction of a complete Lagrangian formulation of a classical system, and conversely, having in hand a very simple minimal Lagrangian formulation of a system, in a sense, I'll make precise, allows one to reconstruct all the structure that I characterized as being characteristic of generic classical Newtonian systems. So that's a sense in which classical mechanics is Lagrangian. I'll then very briefly sketch the geometrical structure needed for Hamiltonian mechanics. Show that it's in no way isomorphic to any of the structures that were used in the first part of the arguments. The conclusion is classical mechanics is not Hamiltonian. I'll then discuss how it is that given that these two, that in fact the underlying geometries of the two frameworks are wildly non-isomorphic, how it is that they end up being able to represent so well the exact same, well, not the exact same, but this. Yeah.
Yes. Can you hear us?
So wait, is this on? Can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
Wait. Yes, we can hear you. yes, I can do that. No. Sorry, Sorry, you guys. I think I just have to continue until you guys get sound. Although you couldn't hear that. So, is there any way to turn their sound off? Or at least turn it down? Yes. This one right here? Thank you. Good. Okay, much better. I think that was the, I think I basically finished the introduction, right? Okay, so let's discuss classical and dynamical systems. So did you tell the lady that they couldn't hear us?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So very crudely speaking, what I mean by a classical system is something that is a physical thing that one can in some sense interact with. It bears quantities, physical quantities. These are magnitudes measurable by some kinds of apparatuses that exploit particular couplings the system has with the environment. It's something that can be in a particular state at a given moment. That's how we individuate it. And the state is the fundamental unit of representation. So it accruing to a state are specific values for all the magnitudes that naturally accrue to a system. And in particular, one demands, of course, that the values for all the quantities are consistent in a given state, are consistent with each other in an appropriate sense. There are usually some sort of certain constraints that must hold among the values of the given quantities in a given state. And one also assumes that the values for the quantities in a given state are sufficient for the unique identification of a state, of a state of the system. Also, in generally, we assume that the system evolves over time, i.e. it changes state over time. So the atheoretical characterization of dynamical system, the mathematical structures I'm going to assume, are really quite minimal. So I assume that we have a space of states. It's just a set of all identifiable states, all states that we think either that we actually have observed, measured, and characterized, or based on various reasonable extrapolations or interpolations we think must exist based on the various couplings that the system actually has with its environment. We generally endow the space of states in classical mechanics with the structure of a differential manifold. And in fact, I'm going to just, unless stated otherwise, I'm going to assume that all structures are smooth. We lose nothing by that. The quantities are represented by scalar and tensorial fields in the space of states. The evolutions are represented by families of vector fields. I call them the kinematically possible vector fields. And there is we also assume from the start that we know what it means to isolate the system. And the mathematical representation of that is that there's a single distinguished vector field in this family of kinematically possible vector fields, generally called the free vector field or the free kinematical vector field. And I claim that in a certain sense, these four structures represent pretty much all the physically significant information you need to begin investigation of a classical system. They certainly don't include everything you need to conclude, to investigate very thoroughly and answer all questions about a physical system. But I do claim that they are minimally necessary if one is even going to have the idea of a classical system get off the ground in the first place. The physical meanings of these elements are, so the quantities serve several roles. The values of the quantities are used to individuate and identify states. The fact that the quantities are continuous and in fact smooth serve to define to characterize the topology and the differential structure of the space of states. The fact that the space of states is arcwise connected means physically that all the states we're dealing with are states of the same system. If the state, if we had a disconnected space of states, that would mean in effect that there were evolutions, that there were two states that weren't connected by any possible physical evolution. So there's no reason to think of that as being the space of states of a single system. Interestingly enough, for classical systems, we also demand of the space of states that it be either, that its dimension be either even dimensional or infinite dimensional, where in a slightly non-standard use of the term, I'll refer to the dimension as the number of degrees of freedom of the system. That term is very often reserved for the dimension of configuration space, but you'll see why I prefer to use it for the dimension of the full space of states. I say it's interesting that this number is always even or infinite, because it actually is mysterious to me. I mean, what that number means physically is it's the minimum number of quantities whose values, the magnitudes of which you have to specify in order to individuate and identify a state. And that number is the same no matter what set of physically independent quantities you choose. Why should it always be even? That to me is quite mysterious. I'll take it back. There actually is exactly one example I know of a classical system that has an odd number of degrees of freedom in my sense, total degrees of freedom. It's something I worked out with Bob Wald and Bob Garoch in conversation one time. So imagine that you have a smoothly curved surface, two-dimensional surface, and you have two wheels that are, two discs that are the same in radius. They're connected at the center by a rigid rod, and the discs are connected by universal joint so that they can freely rotate about the axis and swivel in any direction. As that system rolls around the curved surface, because of the constraints that I've imposed on the relations among all the quantities, if you sit down and work it out, you'll find out that system has only seven total degrees of freedom. So there actually are seemingly classical systems that have an odd number of degrees of freedom, but they're incredibly rare and unusual. No one ever talks about them, and I'm going to ignore them, so at least my practice is no worse than anyone else I've ever heard or talked about, because I've never even heard anyone talk about these. So I'm going to, in fact, assume that classical systems really are even-dimensional.
Mm-hmm. Can you remind us what happens when you have your, n is basically the phase-space dimension, right?
Yes.
So when you have constants of motion, mm-hmm. that's going to reduce the effective dimension mm-hmm. of the kinematic accessible space. So
yes.
If you have an odd number of constants of motion, so you get...
Sure, all that means is... What you just said is that if I give you a full space of states and there are holonomic constraints, I can reduce the dimension of the effective dimension of the number of degrees of freedom. You just told me how you like to represent that system. In actuality, the system actually does have an even number in general, an even number of degrees of freedom. You just told me your favorite way to represent it, using a reduced space of states. The system I just described is not like that. The constraints are not holonomic, and there really are truly seven true degrees of freedom. So the meaning of the evolutions is that first-order differential equations are appropriate for the representation of the evolution of classical systems. That's also mysterious. Why should that have been? We got incredibly lucky there. There's no a priori reason I can think of why that should be true. And isolation physically means we know how to shield systems, which again is an incredibly non-trivial assumption, but one that we make all the time. No, please.
I have a question. Fiddle in the room for a second?
Please.
Yeah. Keep going with your presentation, but I might have to switch this.
Okay.
I always thought that it's in the Hamiltonian picture that one assumes one has coupled first order equations, and then the Lagrangian mm-hmm. picture one has second order differential equations.
Mm-hmm. That is correct. I haven't mentioned Lagrangian or Hamiltonian mechanics yet. I just said we have a differential manifold and a vector field on it. And a vector field on a differential manifold is naturally represented by a first order differential equation. So we haven't gotten fancy yet. And why I claim that the very general characterization of classical systems that is given is atheoretical is because no claim I've made about it and no interpretation of the quantities that the structures that I've introduced depend in any way on the fixation of any particular framework or theory, such as Lagrangian or Hamiltonian mechanics. I haven't mentioned configurations. I haven't mentioned momentum. I haven't tried to distinguish them in any way. These structures, it seems to me, reach down to and represent structure at a very deep level of our understanding of classical systems. This is really fundamentally part of what we mean by a classical system, is that at a bare minimum, we have available to us this family of structures for its representation. So let's talk now about the possible interactions that can occur between this given abstract classical system, as I'll call it, and its environment. And from there, derive the geometry, the structure of the space of the geometry of the space of states. So the goal of this section is to recover the intrinsic geometry of the space of kinematically possible vector fields. So we have, or I should really be family of kinematically possible vector fields, not space. So we have this family of kinematically possible vector fields. They represent all the evolutions. The goal is to see whether, in any sense, this family has a natural geometrical structure. Turns out it does. And based on that natural geometrical structure that accrues to the family of kinematically possible vector fields, we actually will be able to give an intrinsic characterization of what one means by a configuration quantity. We'll actually be able to distinguish we will be able to characterize a distinguished family of quantities that's natural to think of as the configuration-like quantities. That will allow us to construct configuration space. And then a simple argument will show that if you construct the tangent bundle over the constructed configuration space, it's naturally isomorphic to the abstract space of states we started with. So how we're going to do this is by characterizing the possible interactions. That will allow us to give this intrinsic characterization of configurative quantities, differentiating them from velocity-like quantities. And that will allow us to give the intrinsic geometry of the family of possible evolutions, as I mentioned. So configurative quantities, I'll call them configuration-like quantities. They're kind of mysterious, really. Where the hell does configuration space come from anyway? When you have a physical system that you start investigating, the physical system doesn't tell you what you should think of as configuration. Classical systems range over an incredibly broad family of species of types of physical systems. Configuration space wasn't handed down by Prometheus with fire. Why does it seem natural for us to distinguish to separate out a class of quantities and say these are special, these are configuration-like? And if you're raised on a diet of traditional classical mechanical textbooks, this question would never even occur to you, because every single textbook I've ever written pretty much just starts by writing down the physical, by representing the physical system in a preferred system of coordinates and saying this half are the configuration quantities, and they just move merrily along. But why do we need it? I mean, it seems like probing dynamical systems gets one the space of states and the kinematically possible vector fields, the evolutions. Probing by itself, in abstraction, doesn't seem to distinguish among different types of physical quantities. And to make the question perhaps slightly more, to give a pointed example, if you're going to give a Lagrangian formulation of the electromagnetic field, why would you choose the E or the B field for configuration? Is there a principled way to answer that question? As it turns out, the answer I claim is yes. So consider the example of a free Newtonian particle. We'll parameterize the space of states by position and velocity, x and v. These are natural coordinates in the sense that these represent physically distinguished, physically significant quantities for this type of physical system. One way to make that idea precise is that the law of motion, Newton's second law, takes on its canonical form when we use these coordinates, or the coordinates in a certain sense respect the dynamics. The Newton's second law, then, written in perhaps a slightly unusual form as two first-order coupled differential equations, x dot equals v and v dot equals 0. And that gives the kinematical vector field in these, the components of the kinematical vector field for this system are just v0 in these coordinates. That's the free kinematical vector field. So, but to study a physical system, we want to probe it. So let's say I hit the particle with a stick to see what happens. Well, the equations of motion change. X dot equals v doesn't change. That equation stays the same no matter what stick I hit the particle with, and no matter how hard I hit the particle with a stick, and no matter how sharply and quickly I strike the particle. Only the second equation of motion, v dot equals f, changes. So we get a new evolution for the particle. The kinematical vector field, the components of which in our natural coordinate system are just vf. And this leads to an empirical observation. This is the empirical observation that I will use to ground the rest of the argument. Classical systems couple to external systems, the environment, only by way of the equation of motion for the velocities. The equation of motion for the position never changes, no matter what interaction the system is entering into with this environment. And a rough way to think about that, and this is only for heuristic purposes, is that velocities need not evolve continuously as you turn interactions on and off. I can strike the particle with a stick as sharply and quickly as I like. And in the limit of more sharp and more quick strikes, I can eventually approximate a discontinuous velocity as closely as I like. But no matter how sharply I strike and how quickly I strike the particle, the position always evolves continuously. Now, I say that this is only a rough and heuristic idea, and it's not something that I can use to ground the argument on, the trying to distinguish the different kinds of quantities by saying one always evolves continuously and the other sometimes evolves discontinuously. Because, in fact, if you allow distributional solutions to the equations of motion, you can, of course, make the position also evolve discontinuously. If, say, the force is the derivative of a delta function, then you will get discontinuous position evolution.
I mean, when it comes to it, if I understand you correctly, you're saying there's no in-principle limit on the acceleration.
That's correct.
But there is an in-principle limit on the velocity. But that would only be so if you reduce relativity.
No, there's no in-principle. Nothing I've said implies that there's an intrinsic limit on velocity.
Well, in that case, they're on the same footing. I mean, the positions can change very fast at peak velocity. Velocities can change very fast, big acceleration.
That's exactly why I say this is only heuristic and rough, just to give you a physical idea of what's going on. I don't want to even try and make this precise, and I'm not going to base anything in the argument on it.
Oh, okay.
I'm just giving you a kind of, I hope, physically plausible, intuitive picture of one way to try to make sense of the physical difference the precise difference between these two quantities, one of which is that when you turn interactions on, the equations of motion for only one type of quantity changes; the other doesn't.
Okay.
So now let's consider the free electromagnetic field. In fact, so we parameterize a space of states by div b, b dot, div e, and e dot, and it'll be clear in a moment why I use these perhaps somewhat unusual coordinates to parameterize the space of states. The equations of motion are just Maxwell's equations, of course, and in our coordinate system, the components of the evolution of the kinematical vector field for the free Maxwell field is, of course, just that expression. And once again, we're studying physical systems. We want to know what happens when we turn on interaction. So let's say I now hit the Maxwell field with a charge stick. Well, the equations of motion again change. But again, only half the equations of motion change by turning interaction on. Only those that govern the E field directly. In this case, the kinematical vector field now becomes this expression where only the last two components representing the direct evolution of the E field changes. So again, it seems to be the case that only half the quantities directly couple to external systems, the other half don't. The magnetic field, of course, does couple with currents, but it couples in its evolution in time, only to second order, so to speak. It doesn't directly couple, as you can see. When you turn on a current, the equation for B dot doesn't change. So let's generalize. It just seems to be a brute fact about the classical physical world that only some physical quantities that are associated with any classical system can be directly pushed around by the allowed interactions. Others can't. So let's generalize. What we call the configurative quantities are those one cannot directly push around via interactions. They're the ones that don't directly couple to the environment. They're the ones whose equations of motion don't change when you turn an interaction on. And it does seem to be a brute fact about classical systems that when you write down the equations of motion for them, half of them, when you turn an interaction on and see how the equations of motion change, the equations of motion for half the quantities change, the equations of the other half don't.
So have you thought about whether this generalizes in the case of, say, angular momentum, where you have theta and jz as the...
Mm-hmm. It works, yeah. The same thing happens.
So again, it's jz that gets pushed around. And not mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So one way to make this as a more philosophical remark, I'll say. This, in fact, shows us that in a certain sense, x dot equals v is not an equation of motion. It's not really an equation of motion. It's what I call a kinematical constraint. classical mechanics doesn't predict that x dot equals v. It actually requires it as a precondition for its own applicability. If you're studying a system and you're able to ascertain that x dot doesn't equal v, as say happens in the Bohmian account of quantum, in the Bohmian theory of quantum mechanics, or as happens in say Landau and Lipschitz treatment of relativistic fluids, then you're not dealing with a classical system. If you probe the classical system and discover that v dot doesn't equal f, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're not studying a classical system. That may just mean you haven't taken account of all the ambient forces. You may just have gotten the forces wrong. There may be a correction. So v dot equals f seems like a real prediction of the theory in a way that x dot equals v doesn't. That's not relevant for the argument. I just think it's an interesting thing to remark on about the structure of physical theories. But the existence of these kinematical constraints, so in my sense of the term again, div b equals zero and b dot equals minus del cross e are also kinematical constraints. They're not true equations of motion. The existence of these kinematical constraints implies that the difference of two kinematically possible vector fields always has a special form. If I have, for the free Newtonian particle, if this is the evolution of the particle under force F2, that's the evolution of the particle under force F1. If I subtract those two vector fields from each other, I always get a term that has zero in the first component. The same thing happens with the Maxwell fields. I've suggestively bracketed the two different types of components. If I have two Maxwell fields that are undergoing different interactions, if they're coupling with different charge distributions and different current distributions, when I subtract them, I once again get a vector field of this form that has zero in the configurative, what I'm calling the configurative part, and non-zero, generally, in the velocital or non-configurative part. So these difference vectors exactly represent the allowed evolutions. And they point, so just to make clear, F2 minus F1 is clearly a possible force I can impose on the Newtonian particle. And it's when I want to move from the free kinematical vector field to a force of this form, clearly the thing to do is to add this vector field to the free kinematical vector field, and I'll get a particle that evolves under this force. So vector fields of this form represent interactions. And they point only in velocital directions. They encode only rates of change for the velocital quantities, the accelerations. Therefore, as I said, they represent that all and only vector fields of this form represent all possible interactions with the classical system. That implies, though, that the family of interaction vector fields forms a vector space, which is quite nice. And even more nice, it implies that the family of kinematically possible vector fields forms an affine space modeled on that vector space. Because an affine space, it's just like a vector field, a vector space in which you forget the origin. So differences of affine vectors make sense, but additions don't. Or alternatively, if you have an affine vector, you can add it to the normal vector in which the affine space is modeled. And again, recover an element of the affine space. And that's exactly what happens here. You start in any evolution, add an interaction, you get another kinematically possible evolution. So from our simple empirical assumption that interactions only affect half the quantities of a classical system in any given natural representation, we recovered the fact that the interaction vector fields form a vector space, and the kinematically possible vector fields form an affine space, the family of evolutions form an affine space modeled on this vector space. This will allow us to construct now configuration space. Since we now know what configurative quantities are, we can divide the space of states into equivalence classes under the relation is connected by an interaction vector field to. So if I have two points in my space of states, and there's an interaction vector field such that the integral curve, one of the integral curves of that vector field connects the two points, then they are equivalent under my equivalence relation. They lie in the same equivalence class. By construction, all points in the equivalence class have the same configuration in the sense that we've characterized configuration quantities. And so in by using the natural quotient construction, you can turn the space of equivalence classes of these equivalent configurations into a differential manifold. Now, I'm sweeping some technical details under the table here, because you might worry about topological obstructions or something like that for completing the quotient construction. But I claim that it's quite natural to demand for classical systems that none of the topological obstructions that could in principle arise actually do. If you actually look at the space, there are various pathological examples. Like if you're familiar with Norton's dome in the literature, in the philosophical literature, one actually has to exclude from the space of states the single point that represents the ball sitting at the top of the dome in order to do this construction. So I am in some sense excluding certain pathological cases. But I actually don't think that is very important for the argument. So in a natural way then, a point of the space of states becomes a point of configuration space plus a tangent vector at that point, which is just the velocity that point of the space of states attributes to the configuration that the space of states has in virtue of our construction of configuration space. So this to me is somewhat surprising, because the physical meaning of configuration quantity is not, in fact, the way I interpret this argument, the conclusion of this argument, is that what counts as configuration for a classical system is not intrinsic to the system itself, but depends rather on the family of allowed possible interactions of the system with its environment. It depends. It's the configuration, it seems like, is a relational quantity. It depends on what relations the system can actually enter into with other physical systems. I find that somewhat surprising. But anyway, the elements are now all in place to show that, in fact, the space of states is not just isomorphic, but naturally isomorphic to the tangent bundle over configuration space as we've constructed it. So to show that, I won't go through the argument in technical detail. I'll just sketch the outline. So fix a point of configuration space. The free kinematical vector field at that point takes all possible velocity values, roughly speaking. And if a system is in any given configuration, it can in that configuration have in principle any given velocity, while evolving freely. This gives a natural one-to-one onto mapping of the space of states to the tangent bundle of configuration space. You take a point of configuration and a tangent vector representing the velocity of that configuration, and that defines a point of the tangent bundle of configuration space. It's easy to show that this map is one-to-one onto and smooth. So by using our assumed structure of a distinguished vector field, you get a natural isomorphism between what we started with, this abstract space of states, and the tangent bundle over configuration space. So in a certain sense, classical systems like to live on tangent bundles. The argument I just sketched, by the way, is something that Bob Garoch told me in private conversation. I don't think he's ever published it anywhere. So I will now use this to show. I'll now use the structures and arguments we've developed to show how, given the tools in hand, we can construct a Lagrangian formulation of one of these abstract classical systems. Abstract in the sense that it's characterized so far just by the abstract space of states, the family of kinematically possible vector fields, the family of interaction vector fields. So the math starts to get hard, and I'm not going to go into it in great detail. If you have questions about it, feel free to stop and ask me. Feel free to ask me during question and answer period. I'm going to just sketch it, I hope, in a relatively straightforward and somewhat intuitive manner. So the goal of this section is first to argue that these abstract classical systems, as I've characterized them, are Lagrangian in the sense that having all these structures and in hand allows one to formulate a full Lagrangian representation of the system in the sense of being able to construct the Euler-Lagrange equation for that system and show that the solutions of the Euler-Lagrange equation match the possible evolutions. And contrarily, to show that Lagrangian systems are classical, that if we have a Lagrangian representation of a classical system in a very minimal sense, that allows us to reconstruct all the structure that we found characterized these abstract classical systems. So in order to do this, we're going to exploit the intrinsic geometry of tangent bundles. Tangent bundles have a distinguished vector space of vector fields. They're vertical vectors. They're the vectors that point straight up and down the fibers. It's easy to see that the family of all vertical vector fields forms a vector space. That's just encoded in the fiber bundle structure. It also, though, this seems not to be so well known, the tangent bundles naturally have a family of a distinguished affine space of vector fields modeled on those vertical vector fields. They're the lifts of curves from the base space. Is there chalk? So if I have, my base space here, and I have a tangent bundle here, and the projection down, a curve on the base space, of course, is just a collection of points and a tangent vector at every point. But a point and a tangent vector is just a point of the tangent bundle. So as I smoothly move along this curve, I also smoothly develop a curve on the tangent bundle. This is called the lift of the curve from the base space to the tangent bundle. Obviously, not all curves on tangent bundles are lifts from the base space. So in fact, the family of vector fields whose integral curves are these lift curves are what I call them second order vector fields, because in fact, in a natural sense, they represent second order differential equations of on the quantities of the base space. And they do in fact form an affine space modeled on the vertical vector fields. I'll briefly show how that works in a moment. And it also turns out that that family of this affine family of vector fields on the tangent bundle form all possible solutions to the Euler Lagrange equation, if you write the Euler Lagrange equation on the tangent bundle. And there's also a natural one up, one down index tensor that lives on the tangent bundle. It's called an almost tangent structure. And the family of affine vector fields completely encodes this tensor field. Some mathematicians define the affine structure as a G structure. I prefer using, for my purposes, it's easier to represent it as a tensor field. They're completely equivalent. You can go back and forth between the two representations. So in order to make all this a little more precise, I'll first tell you what an almost tangent structure is. For the way I characterize it, it's a smooth tensor field on an even dimensional manifold that satisfies the two conditions. Considered as a linear operator on the tangent planes of the manifold, the tensor has rank n everywhere. It has rank half the dimension of the space. And it's nilpotent. So it's easy to see that as a linear operator, the range of this tensor equals its own kernel, which is an n-dimensional distribution on the manifold. And in the special case where this almost tangent structure lives on a tangent bundle, it has particularly nice properties. It's relatively easy to see, although I won't go into the details. You can ask me about them if you like. That the range and kernel of the almost tangent structure on the tangent bundle are precisely the family of vertical vector fields. And there's actually a distinguished vertical vector field on the tangent bundle. It's often called the Liouville vector field. It's basically the position, if you consider each fiber as a vector space on its own, the Liouville vector field is basically the vector field that tells you how far away in the fiber you are from the origin. It's the position vector field. In natural coordinates, it is written. It is written like that. And it turns out it's rather easy to see once you see what a second order vector field is, which I don't think I wrote down, did I? No, I should have. I'm sorry. this is I'm talking in not the same order that my slides are, but so I think I'll have to rearrange my slides next time I give this talk. It feels more natural to get to talk as I've been doing than the way the slides are going. On the tangent bundle, it turns out that all second order vector fields, all these lifts, all vector fields that arise as lifts from the base space, when you act on them with the Allmos tangent structure, give you the Liouville vector field. That's why they form an affine space. Because if you subtract any two of them, you will in fact get a vertical vector field that the Allmos tangent structure annihilates since it's in the kernel. So using the Allmos tangent structure that tangent bundles naturally have, there is a very elegant invariant geometrical formulation of the Euler-Lagrange equation. So I claim that this equation is equivalent to the ordinary Euler-Lagrange equation written out in coordinate forms. It's an easy calculation to do. If you fix natural coordinates on the tangent bundle, you know, say x for the base space and then xv are the natural coordinates on the tangent bundle, and you expand the Lie derivative using an arbitrary derivative operator. We'll say the easiest one is the component derivative operator associated with your coordinates. And just write everything out. It turns out that this is just the Euler-Lagrange equation as you know and love it in your standard coordinates. So z here is the vector, is the solution to the Euler-Lagrange equation. And I like writing the Euler-Lagrange equation this way because it makes it manifest that all you need to formulate the Euler-Lagrange equation on a manifold is an Allmos tangent structure. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. No, the connection is arbitrary. It's only acting on scalar fields. You can use any derivative operator you want. So you don't need a distinguished connection. It's worth remarking that if in fact you do expand the Lie derivative, let's say that you pick an arbitrary derivative operator and you expand the Lie derivative in terms of your arbitrarily fixed derivative operator, and you write out the equation in expanded form, so to speak. Under the surface here, there actually is a two-form, this guy, which although it's not obvious at all, if you do the calculation, it turns out that this two-form is also not dependent on choice of derivative operator. And this two-form, in fact, is closed manifestly. And it's not hard to show that it actually is invertible, i.e. it forms a symplectic structure when and only when L is regular in the ordinary sense. So when the Jacobian of L with respect to the velocities doesn't equal zero. That will be relevant later on when I compare Lagrange mechanics to Hamiltonian mechanics. But it is worth remarking that this symplectic structure is not fixed once and for all. It depends essentially on choice of Lagrangian. And in fact, even for physically equivalent Lagrangians, in the sense that they give rise to the same solution, say if you add a total time derivative, if you add a total time derivative to Lagrangian, that doesn't change the solution. Doing so actually does change the symplectic structure. So the symplectic structure is in no way uniquely picked out, even for a particular solution to the Euler-Lagrange equation. So I've already mentioned second-order vector fields. I've already mentioned that, in fact, Lagrangian vector fields, the solutions to the Euler-Lagrange equation, are always second-order vector fields. And I claim that makes sense, because as I remarked earlier, second-order vector fields are the natural representation of second-order ordinary equations on the base space. And as you remarked earlier, the Euler-Lagrange equation we know is second-order, so that makes sense on physical grounds. So I remarked earlier, but I won't go through the argument that if you just give me a tangent bundle as a pure manifold, you don't tell me it's a tangent bundle, and you give me a family of affine a family of vector fields on it that forms an affine space and that has certain other nice properties, it's integral in the sense of Arrhenius, it's complete, and there are a few more technical properties that this family has to satisfy. Then, in fact, I can use that, and which, in fact, the family of second-order vector fields on the tangent bundle does satisfy. And again, I can go into the technical details if you want, but they're not important for the argument. Knowledge of that family, of that affine space of vector fields, allows me to reconstruct the almost tangent structure. Interestingly enough, JAB also encodes the classical kinematical constraint x dot equals b. It's all you need to represent that classical kinematical constraint, and this I claim is the natural representation of where QI and BI are natural coordinates on the tangent bundle. This is the natural representation of this constraint for the Newtonian system. And it also turns out that if in fact I have a family of coordinates, a family of natural coordinates on a space, and I don't know the space is a tangent bundle, but I can find a one up down index tensor, one up one down index tensor, such that the families of coordinates satisfy these relations and a few other nice properties, it turns out that this can work when and only when this guy is an almost tangent structure. So knowledge of the kinematical constraints will also give you the almost tangent structure. So let's use our canonical isomorphism of this abstract space of states that we started with. So in the previous section, I argued that the abstract space of states was naturally isomorphic to the tangent bundle. Let's use this canonical isomorphism. Under this canonical isomorphism, if we push the kinematical vector fields over to the tangent bundle configuration space, we get, I claim, the image under that mapping is the affine space of Lagrangian vector fields. They have the same physical meaning. They're the solutions to the equations of motion. And if you push the interaction vector fields over using this isomorphism, you get the vector space of vertical vector fields has the same meaning in Lagrangian mechanics. The vertical vector fields represent the possible interactions, possible generalized forces. And knowledge of these, as I've already remarked, suffices to allow, if I know this affine space, I know this vector space, that allows me to construct JAB, which allows me to write down the Euler Lagrange equation. So in a very natural sense, the abstract classical system, with the simple empirical assumption we started with, allows me to construct a full Lagrangian representation of the system. Because this is all you need to write down the Euler Lagrange equation. And by construction, for any Lagrangian, the solution to that Euler Lagrange equation will precisely be the family of vector fields that are the image under the canonical isomorphism of the possible evolutions of the abstract classical system. God, that was a long sentence. Okay. So that concludes the argument, by the way, that abstract classical systems, as I've characterized them, are Lagrangian. So I'll very, very quickly sketch the converse result. Say that we have a differential manifold. We don't know anything about it yet, except the following facts. We know that there's a nonlinear functional on it that takes scalar fields to vector fields. And for the moment, that's all we know. And we also know that the family of vector that for all that for the family of scalar fields for which the functional is defined, the complete family of vector fields it maps to forms an affine space that has these certain further nice properties. I will call such a thing an Euler-Lagrange operator. It turns out that a manifold supports such an Euler-Lagrange operator if and only if it's a tangent bundle. And the operator's action allows one to recover the space over which the manifold I originally gave you, in its pure undifferentiated form, it allows you to recover the complete structure of that manifold as a tangent bundle over its base space. So in a certain sense, knowing how to formulate and solve the Euler-Lagrange equation in a very minimal sense, and I can write down all the conditions if you like. They're not very illuminating, but if you're curious, ask me here in question period or something. Already tells you that you are on a tangent bundle. I find this actually quite surprising because, as we'll see in a moment, Hamiltonian mechanics is quite freewheeling. You can do Hamiltonian mechanics, pretty much anywhere, as long as you got even dimensional orientable manifold. That manifold doesn't have to have any particular differential topology. But the intrinsic geometry of the Euler Lagrange equation is extremely restrictive. You can formulate this operator only on a tangent bundle. So now, using the reverse of the argument that we just used to show that classical systems are Lagrangian, we can once again use the canonical isomorphism of the tangent bundle with the abstract space of states to push the affine space of Lagrangian vector fields back to the abstract space of states. We get the kinematically possible evolutions on the abstract classical system, has same physical meaning. Push the vertical vector fields on tangent bundle back to the abstract space of states. Get the vector space of interaction vector fields, has the same physical meaning. So in a natural sense, if I have a minimal Lagrangian formulation of a system, I can reconstruct the abstract classical representation, as I've called it. So in a very natural sense, Lagrangian systems are also classical. It's worth just stopping for a minute to remark on the physical meaning of the structures we've talked about so far. So the almost tangent structure encodes this classical kinematical constraint that allows one to characterize configurative quantities. And it also characterizes the affine space structure of the solutions to the equations of motion. So it seems completely characteristic of classical systems that their family of possible evolutions has this affine space structure. The Lagrangian two form I mentioned earlier, its only purpose in life is to ensure uniqueness and existence of solutions when it actually is symplectic, when the Lagrangian is regular. It doesn't do anything else. It has no other function in life. The Lagrangian itself not only encodes dynamical evolution, but when regular, it ensures that the Lagrangian two form is symplectic. And so it's the Lagrangian in Lagrangian mechanics is a funny creature because it mixes up both kinematics and dynamics. Its kinematical feature is ensuring existence and uniqueness of solutions. And its dynamical features are obviously it gives you the solution to the equation, it actually gives you the evolution. Okay. So I started about 8 after, so I still have about 13 minutes left. If that's okay, if I go for an hour. Okay, good. So I will now very quickly sketch why classical mechanics is not Hamiltonian. So to formulate Hamilton's equation in invariant geometrical terms, one needs and only needs a fixed canonical symplectic structure and a Hamiltonian. The space of states can be any symplectic manifold, not necessarily something isomorphic to a tangent bundle. In particular, it doesn't have to be a cotangent bundle. And there actually are real physical physically important examples of manifolds on which one writes down Hamilton's equation that are not isomorphic to a cotangent bundle. A nice one is if you have a spherically symmetric system and you write down the configuration space for it and take the cotangent bundle. If you factor the cotangent bundle by the group of spatial rotations, you get a reduced manifold which has a natural symplectic structure on it. And when you write Hamilton's equation using that symplectic structure, you recover the Euler equations for rotating rigid bodies. But that space of states is not isomorphic to a cotangent bundle, and a fortiori is not isomorphic to a tangent bundle. The space of dynamical evolutions, the space of all possible solutions to Hamilton's equation for all Hamiltonians, it's easy to see, is actually a Lie algebra. It's not an affine space. It's a Lie algebra that's based on the symplectic structure. And it's easy to see that, in fact, because the family of dynamical evolutions forms a vector space, you know, the vector space underlying the Lie algebra, if we want to characterize the possible interactions that Hamiltonian mechanics supports in the same way that we did in the abstract classical sense, where we're going to demand that what I mean by possible interaction vector field is vector field I can add to an evolution so as to get another evolution, then in this case, clearly, the space of interaction vector fields is exactly the same as the Hamiltonian vector field itself, since the space of Hamiltonian vector fields itself forms a vector space already. We have a space of states that's not necessarily isomorphic to the classical space of states. We have the family of dynamical evolutions whose geometric structure is in no way isomorphic to the natural structure of the family of classical evolutions. And we have a family of interaction vector fields whose geometrical structure is in no way isomorphic to the geometrical structure of the family of classical interactions. So my only conclusion is that classical mechanics is not Hamiltonian, and Hamiltonian mechanics is not classical. Sure. If you're going to ask about the Legendre, if you're going to ask about the Legendre transform, I can talk about it in a minute. But go on.
Oh, not okay. You have a better question. But I mean, is there some way to? I mean, if I understand what you're doing, you're kind of saying, well, classical mechanics construed. I mean, sorry, Hamiltonian mechanics construed as a mathematical formalism is not classical mechanics. But is there some way to kind of restrict the mathematical formalism to physically realistic cases and recover some?
Excellent question, and I'm just about to talk about that. It is interesting to note, again, that Hamiltonian mechanics does have a set of kinematical constraints. For Lagrangian mechanics, recall, the kinematical constraints you can roughly say as half the canonical quantities are dynamical derivatives of the other half. The velocity-like quantities are dynamical derivatives of the configuration-like quantities. In Hamiltonian mechanics, the kinematical constraints that the canonical quantities must satisfy are the ordinary Poisson brackets. Notice that, so not only, as I remarked earlier, that all the underlying geometrical structures are non-isomorphic, but Hamiltonian mechanics has no responsibility. It has no obligation to respect the classical kinematical constraints. It does not follow from the Poisson bracket that Q dot equals P, or Q dot is even proportional to P, or Q dot is even a linear function of P. It's Hamiltonian mechanics, the canonical quantities have no obligation whatsoever to respect the classical constraints. The closest analog I can come to for the Lagrangian theorem for Hamiltonian mechanics, the theorem I stated earlier showed how to characterize the structure that one needed for the Euler-Lagrange equations by exploiting the natural geometry of the kinematical structures that accrue to classical systems. This is the closest theorem I can come up with that does the same thing for Hamiltonian mechanics, that makes use of the kinematical constraints natural to Hamiltonian mechanics and allows you to recover Hamilton's equation from those kinematical constraints. Fix an even-dimensional or animal manifold with a vector space of vector fields on it and a Poisson bracket structure. Then the Poisson bracket arises from a symplectic structure, and the vector space includes all and only solutions to Hamilton's equations formulated with that symplectic structure, if and only if the vector space of vector fields spans the tangent planes. That means that at every point of the manifold you're on, and any vector at that point, there's at least one family of there's at least one vector field in your family that takes on that value at that point. It doesn't say that the family of vector fields includes all vector fields on the manifold. And the manifold has a group of coordinate systems whose coordinate functions satisfy the canonical Poisson bracket relations, and whose associated coordinate vector fields leave the vector space invariant under the action of a Lie bracket. So that's how you can actually recover Hamilton's equation by assuming nothing but the kinematical constraints, just as you can recover the Euler-Lagrange equation by assuming only the classical kinematical constraints. But notice this theorem does not restrict the differential topology of the manifold in any way. It's not like the Lagrangian theorem, where the kinematical constraints forces the manifold to have a particular differential topology that have a tangent bundle. And again, it's worth remarking on what the physical meanings of these structures are. In the Hamiltonian case, the canonical symplectic structure ensures existence and uniqueness of solutions. So that's like the symplectic structure that actually appears in Lagrangian mechanics. But it actually does more than that. It also encodes the kinematical constraints, and it also ensures conservation of energy, neither of which the symplectic structure in Lagrangian mechanics does. The Hamiltonian itself encodes the dynamics. Hamiltonian mechanics is funny because is nice in the sense that there's a complete clear separation between kinematics and dynamics here. All the kinematics is in the symplectic structure, all the dynamics is in the Hamiltonian. Recall that in the Lagrangian case, they were kind of mixed up. So now to address your question in part. So the preceding argument raises, I claim, at least four interesting questions. If Hamiltonian mechanics doesn't respect the kinematical constraints intrinsic to, that should be, classical systems, how can it provide adequate representations of classical systems, for instance, this simple harmonic oscillator? Why does Lagrangian mechanics always respect the constraints of classical systems? Because we know the Hamiltonian and Lagrangian formulations to be related by the Legendre transform, what happens in the passage from Lagrangian to Hamiltonian mechanics, or if you like the inverse Legendre transform going the other way, that expunges respect for those classical kinematical constraints? And is any structure in Hamiltonian mechanics isomorphic in a physically significant way to any structure in Lagrangian mechanics? So this directly answers your question. The way that Hamiltonian mechanics respects classical kinematical constraints is that just by ad hoc fiat, because this follows from nothing natural in the structure of the mathematical theory itself, we always restrict ourselves to Hamiltonians that whose only dependence on the momenta is that they're quadratic in the momenta. So we always only consider Hamiltonians of this form. Where alpha is basically any tensor field whose components depends only on configuration. In fact, I think I can say in no textbook I've ever read is it ever remarked that Hamiltonian mechanics works for classical systems only because we restrict ourselves to Hamiltonians of this special form. But again, nothing in Hamiltonian mechanics says you got to do that. This is a perfectly good Hamiltonian, as far as Hamiltonian mechanics is concerned. So is this. So is this, for that matter. None of them give you classically possible evolutions. And for none of them is it the case that this relation holds. When the Hamiltonian is of the special form that we restrict ourselves to, more or less arbitrarily, at least so far as the intrinsic structure of Hamiltonian mechanics itself is concerned, this becomes an identity. It has no physical content. It encodes the kinematical constraint of classical systems only in virtue of restricting ourselves to Hamiltonians of this special form. But like I say, it's justifiable by nothing intrinsic to the theory. Nothing in the theory says only use scalar functions of that special form. So why does Lagrangian mechanics always respect the kinematical constraints? Well, there are two answers to that. I mean, the simplest way to say it is, as I hope it should be clear by now, it's pretty much built in from the start that it's got to. There's another way to show that the Lagrangian mechanics must respect these classical kinematical constraints. So you may have noticed so far that I haven't mentioned variational calculus at all. I just started by writing the Euler-Lagrange equation on the tangent bundle just as an equation. But if you consider the standard variational problem, you want to minimize the action, I claim that in fact this variational problem is well posed only because half the coordinates are essentially the time derivatives of the other half of the coordinates. This complete, let's try to ignore that property. Let's consider the following completely general variational problem. Let's try to extremize that integral. It has no non-trivial solutions. It essentially, the fact that this is the time derivative of this allows the crucial switching of the variation and the differentiation in the integration by parts when you derive the Euler-Lagrange equation. If that relation doesn't hold, you can't derive the Euler-Lagrange equation. And in fact, I claim in general, this has no non-trivial solution at all anyway on an arbitrary manifold. So if you consider in order for the variational problem to be well posed, you need the classical kinematical constraints. And if you just start with the geometric formulation as I did, and don't even worry about the variational problem, again, you see that the structure of the family of evolutions demands that kinematical constraints be satisfied. So what about the Legendre transform? The Legendre transform is only in special cases. Is it a diffeomorphism of the tangent bundle to phase space? But the important point is that it does not map second order vector fields to Hamiltonian vector fields, at least not all of them. It clearly, for any given Lagrangian, if it's regular and defines a good Legendre transform, it will in fact map its own solution to the Hamiltonian vector field that is the solution to the corresponding Hamiltonian. But in general, if you use that same Legendre transform to map other second order vector fields over to the cotangent bundle, they can map to anything. In particular, they do not map to an affine subspace of the Lie algebra of Hamiltonian vector fields under an arbitrary Legendre transform. So the Legendre transform it's clear that it doesn't preserve the classical constraints. And the Legendre transform is not an isomorphism of any kinematical structure between the two. And I think I'm 2 minutes over, so I think I will wrap up there.
No, you've got to do your example.
Is that the first question?
Okay, answer the first question.
Well, let's stay here.
And the two solutions giving the same predictions.
Okay. So you may have noticed I didn't address the fourth question that I started with here. Is any structure in Hamiltonian mechanics isomorphic to any structure in Lagrangian mechanics? So let's write the Lagrangian for the simple harmonic oscillator. You set all the constants, the mass, and everything to one. Who cares about that stuff anyway? We're theoreticians here, right? We don't actually care about the actual value of mass and the spring constant. We just care that it has some value, right? So it's you plug it in and you get the solution to the vector field is, I always get the minus signs wrong, but I think it's this has got to be q dot, and this is like minus q dot or something like that. Anyway, so the force is just or minus. And the phase portrait, if we're just on R2, then the phase portrait for any given initial conditions is just, of course, a circle. Do the same thing for Hamiltonian mechanics. So in this case, the Legendre transform says that B maps. The Legendre transform is V maps to P, which we define as the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the velocity. The Hamiltonian is PQ minus L. So that ends up equaling 1/2 Q squared plus 1/2 P squared. And Hampton's equation then gives you, Q dot equals dhdp, which is just p, and p dot equals dhdq, which is just Q. And once again, if we represent the cotangent bundle by R2, then the face portrait is the same, is the exact same circle. So you may ask, I've claimed that there's no physically significant isomorphic structures between Lagrangian mechanics and Hamiltonian mechanics. But this seems prima facie to be wrong, right? Because their solutions have the exact same geometry. So what exactly does my claim mean that there's no physically significant isomorphism structure? Well, the only geometrical structure between the two that actually is isomorphic is the symplectic structure. But recall, I claim the symplectic structure has completely different physical meaning in each of the two frameworks. In the Lagrangian case, all the symplectic structure does is ensure existence and uniqueness of solutions. And it also is not canonical. It depends on choice of Lagrangian itself. In the Hamiltonian case, by contrast, as I remarked, the symplectic structure, its physical significance is existence and uniqueness of solutions, encoding of kinematical constraints, and conservation of energy. So even though those are formally isomorphic for any particular Lagrangian, they don't have the same physical meaning. The only thing that actually has the same physical meaning is the brute prediction, is the shape of the evolution. But that's not very interesting. If all I know is that two theories agree on their brute predictions, that does not give me enough to work out what the physical meaning of all the mathematical structures are that play a role in producing those predictions. And for the philosophers in the audience, to say that pure sameness of solutions to equations of motion gives you sameness of meaning of underlying structures would be nothing more than just the barest, most naive form of verificationism. So, which I think has been pretty well discredited as a viable position for the interpretation of physical theories. So that's the answer to Bill's question. Yes?
Your statement about the Hamiltonian taking that form, it's a long time since I've thought about this, but if you're dealing with the Hamiltonian formulation of motion of a charged particle in a magnetic field, mm-hmm. the momentum is equal to something like Q plus A, where A is the vector potential with some constants mm-hmm. in there. So right. It isn't the case that Q dot equals P there.
Right, that's a very funny case. And So wait, let me see if that's right. So you're claiming the Hamiltonian is...
It's years since I've actually calculated with this, so it's gotten mm-hmm. very fuzzy in my memory.
Okay.
But it's something like, I think, P minus E over C A, little e, electrical charge, where those are vectors. No. E A is upstairs.
E over C.
E times A, and then, yeah, and then you take the dot product of that with itself, and then you add on the potential. That's probably making a gauge choice.
That's what I would say is that the only reason that this is going to work is because you have the gauge freedom in the A, and I'm not dealing with Hamiltonian systems that admit of gauge freedom.
Well, that's the other point I was going to make, which is the Legendre transformation. Again, this has got fuzzy in my memory. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, there's Dirac's theory of constrained Hamiltonian systems, which you need for canonical quantization of mm-hmm. the gauge theory. And there, indeed, the Legendre transformation, it's not invertible.
That's right.
But you still have a Hamiltonian mechanics coming out at the end.
Right, but yeah, but you don't, but you can't derive a Lagrangian from it, precisely because. Well,
you start with the Lagrangian, mm-hmm. and then you derive a Hamiltonian formalism.
Right, but once you have the Hamiltonian formalism, you actually can't go back to the Lagrangian.
Okay, that's very possibly so.
Yeah. Precisely because the inverse Legendre is not well posed.
So you've defined some notion of classical systems. Mm-hmm. It's independent of the Hamiltonian Lagrangian picture. Mm-hmm. Would you also claim there's some kind of physical meaning to that mathematical definition of classical systems, and that systems that don't satisfy those criteria are not physically realizable?
That's a hard question, because you know, we don't even, you know, at bottom we don't think the world's classical anyway. So it's kind of a counterfactual. If the world really were in some sense classical, would it be possible for systems in that possible world to manifest structure besides the one that I wrote up there?
I mean, I'm very sensitive to that, but at the same time, one could define a whole domain of phenomena, macroscopic phenomena, in which classical mechanics works phenomenally well, by which I mean Hamiltonian and Lagrangian pictures.
Right.
And so, I mean, what I'm picking at in particular is that, you know, people study Hamiltonians of angular momenta, where you can write down some pretty much any polynomial you want of, say, the J, X, Y, and Z components. I don't think they'll satisfy your criterion H equals P squared, where you think of P as a generalized momenta. And my question then would be, do you have an argument that those systems aren't physically realistic? They're just mathematical abstractions? Or?
No, my claim is actually, in that case, there's always a canonical transformation to some generalized momenta in which you can write the Hamiltonian in that form.
I find that kind of surprising, because
I agree. It's surprising. But I claim that's true. I think that in fact there's
even with some complex holding on the constraints or something like that. You mean, is that the idea?
Yeah, but I think there's a proof of this, I believe, in Arnold's book. What's that book called? It might just be called Classical Mechanics or Animal Mechanics. Or
Mathematical Methods of Classical Mechanics.
That one.
All right. Let's look into that.
That example you managed of a system characterized by 7 quantities, how does it fit into your scheme of dividing the quantities?
Doesn't at all.
Oh, yeah. Good question.
It doesn't at all. But that's manifestly a system that you can't write either a Lagrangian or Hamiltonian representation of. You can possibly write a constrained Hamiltonian representation of it. I'm not sure. That would use a presymplectic structure. I don't know. But that's exactly why I said that I would exclude it from the start, because I don't know what to say about it. It seems like a very incredibly weird example. It's the only example I've ever been able to come up with. That of a classical system, what looks like a classical system, it doesn't have an even number of degrees of freedom. And I've never seen any discussion of these kinds of systems in either the physics or the philosophy literature. So my ignoring them, as I said, is at least no worse than anyone else does. But I find that example a complete mystery. I don't know what to say about it.
As a minor comment, if doing that in terms of constraint formalism would also be really hard. Because usually if you impose a constraint on a Hamiltonian system, you cut 2 degrees of freedom.
Exactly.
So you somehow have to only cut an odd.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So exactly. So really that's why I was hedging. It's not clear to me that you can even represent the system as a constrained Hamiltonian.
So you're just saying that you were excluding gauge theories from your Feynman.
Yes.
So early on you used electromagnetism as an example, but that was before you got into, as you said, the mathematical part.
Yeah.
So I'm also wondering about once you get to the mathematical part, whether you're excluding relativistic systems as well.
Yes, I am.
You're dealing with
systems that in some sense or other can be modeled by something like Newton's second law.
Okay, so then the follow-up question is whether you've thought about whether that is tied in, that kind of restriction is tied into the privileging of free systems at the beginning of your setup.
It absolutely is. I have no idea how to run these arguments without privileging a vector field at the start, and calling it the end. Just calling it by fiat, the free evolution.
Okay.
I mean, I don't think that's an unreasonable demand, because we do in fact think that every physical system has a unique free evolution. I'm not just referring to the mouse in my pocket. I actually think that most physicists and philosophers do think that most physical systems have a unique, distinguished free evolution.
But But you need more than that, right? Because then the whole, the key to it is characterizing the allowed class of interactions, right? And you do that with respect to
No, you don't need to do that. The only place where the free vector field plays an important role is in constructing the distinguished isomorphism between the abstract space of states and the tangent bundle. That's what makes the isomorphism natural. If you don't have the free vector field, you can't construct a natural isomorphism. They'll still be isomorphic if you don't have a distinguished vector field.
Oh, I see.
There's just no way to pick one out as a privileged one.
Oh.
And it's only under that privileged one that the affine space of free of kinematically possible evolutions on the abstract space of states maps to the second order vector fields on the tangent bundle. So it really does seem like the right one to use if you for full right.
At least in the Newtonian context.
And I actually have played around with similar arguments in special relativity. The family of unit time-like vector fields on Minkowski space-time, unfortunately, does not have a very elegant or pretty algebraic structure that I've been able to find. And it's actually somewhat mysterious to me how Lagrangian mechanics works for special relativistic systems. That's a question I'd really like to answer. I also suspect that there's a way to run the same kind of argument for quantum mechanics. If you take the kinematical constraints to be something like the von Neumann algebra of operators, whether you can somehow or other construct the Schrödinger equation from it. I would like to know that. I don't know. Whether in fact there's any natural sense of, since we often write the Hilbert space of a quantum system as the Hilbert space over as the L2 functions over configuration space, whether there's any way to recover configuration space in that sense from the algebra of observables. And I don't know the answer to that, but I think it would be fun to find out.
Yeah, my recollection is that Dirac, when he discusses constrained Hamiltonian systems, actually considers the example of special relativity single particle.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's nice. I'll have a look at that. Thank you.
There's this ADM formulation of GR as a whole, so I'm not surprised there's probably a simpler one for special relativity.
The ADM formulation isn't a true Hamiltonian formulation. You don't have a symplectic structure. You only have a pre-symplectic structure.
Oh, really? That's amazing.
I didn't quite get the first part of Doreen's question about the gauge stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't quite get the full extent of the way you were answering that. Could you just remind me or expand? Maybe I wasn't following.
Well, I guess the short answer is I'm just excluding gauge theories by fiat from the start. If you include gauge theories as Marcus pointed out, the argument about Hamiltonians doesn't work.
Okay.
Gwen, he's exactly right about that.
Yeah.
Robert, you had a question?
Another way to look at the distinction you made between the kinematical constraints that aren't equations of motion and the ones that are is that the ones that aren't really are just part of the sort of definition that make a system classical and that define the classical quantities as something that has a mathematical representation, right? And so if I start from the intuition that the point of Lagrangian systems is ones that I can sort of unpack into a kind of classical Newtonian space-time representation. And Hamiltonian systems are the ones that I can't necessarily do that unless certain other special assumptions are imposed.
Right.
And my intuition is that, well, that's the point of Hamiltonian mechanics being applicable to a much broader class of systems, and it's a way of understanding the relationship between, say, for example, classical mechanics and quantum mechanics. Then, if there's nothing really wrong with that intuition, is it all right if I come away with your talk thinking that you've made this vague idea very nicely, elegantly precise?
That's
the essential content of what you've pointed out.
Yeah, I think that would be, especially if you emphasize the elegant and the elegant. I think that'll be a very good take-home message.
All right, let's thank Eric again.